Welcome to Good Christophian Talks. I'm Levi.
And I'm Chris.
And I'm Brian. Thank you for joining us this week.
On this podcast, we select one talk a week to help us get the Bible in our daily newsfeed.
We post a new episode at the start of each week with a short intro beforehand to kind of set the stage for the talk you're about to listen to.
And now, let's talk more about this week's talk.
Hello, my name is Justin, and I'll be your host for this week and the following week. For this class, I've chosen a talk by James Robinson. This class made a fairly significant impact on me several years ago, and I really wanted to share it with everyone. This talk gets back to the basics. It tries to prove the death, but more importantly, the resurrection of Jesus, a backbone of our faith. So now we'll turn it over to James.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. I'm glad to see you all here tonight because our subject tonight is He is not here, He is risen. And hopefully it'll be a very interesting subject for you all. I greatly enjoyed researching it. The subject for tonight officially is He is not here, He is risen. That'll probably be the subject on whatever board we have outside, if we have a board outside at the moment. If we don't, that's the official title. But what you're going to be hearing tonight is, more simply stated, as proof that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. What I'm going to try and do in this talk is go through and give evidence for why we can believe that Jesus Christ honestly did rise from the dead. And to start off, I'll explain why this is important. Because Jesus Christ rising from the dead is the foundation of Christianity. You'll notice I have a quote up there, 1 Corinthians 15. This is from the Apostle Paul, a Christian, writing to other Christians. And he says, "If Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith." Obviously, Paul thought the resurrection was pretty important. That quote, by the way, is from the New International Version. All quotations tonight on my slides and that I will be reading are from the New International Version for the simple reason that it's very easy to understand. And tonight, I want to make sure that what I'm saying is easy to understand, because it should be easy to understand that we have a firm and good reason to believe that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Now, as for why this is important, Jesus Christ himself claimed that he rose from the dead. The reference I have up there, Matthew 17, 22 to 23, is pretty much the same as what we already read earlier in Luke 24. Jesus claimed that he was going to be betrayed and killed, and rise again the third day. This is what he said. If Jesus said this, and it didn't happen, then he is a liar. And therefore, it is hugely important whether or not he rose from the dead. Identically, his disciples afterwards all claim that he rose from the dead. Acts 2 and 32 is only one reference among many in the New Testament, all claiming the same thing, that Jesus rose from the dead. If he didn't rise from the dead, that all his disciples are liars too, and the entire Christian faith is founded on a lie. If that is the case, then I might as well not be speaking up here. That's why our subject tonight is that the resurrection did actually happen, because if it didn't actually happen, none of us needs to be here tonight. Finally, there's one other important point. Christianity has a lot of things that are important to it, and tonight I'm not going to talk about everything that Christianity deals with. But one thing that you have to understand is Christianity is based on Jesus Christ as a living Savior. If Jesus Christ is dead in a tomb right now, or moldering in the ground someplace, then Christianity is useless because it does not have a Savior. Its Savior is dead, and there is no hope you can put in somebody who is dead. But tonight, we're going to get into if he was resurrected. And if he was resurrected, that means some things as well. First of all, it means that when Jesus made the claim that he was going to die and be resurrected, and it actually happened, that's pretty astounding. You can go talk to any undertaker, and they will not tell you that their corpses that they're dealing with rise from the dead. This is not a common occurrence. This is something we call a miracle. And if he is able to accurately predict a miraculous occurrence, then we might want to believe the other things that he said. Identical case for his disciples. If they're all saying something totally astounding happened, and it actually did happen, then we might have reason to believe the other things they say. And they said some other pretty fascinating things. One of them is quoted on the screen there. For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what he has done. That's a pretty scary prediction, that Christ is going to come and judge the world. And so, if they were right about that, maybe we need to lend some credence to the other things they said. And that's going to be a scary proposition. So again, our subject is important. Did Jesus rise from the dead, or didn't he? That's what I'm going to try and prove to you tonight. Now, proof is an interesting thing. How do we prove something, and especially something quite so amazing as a person rising from the dead? It is not hard to prove to you tonight that gravity exists. Here I have a book. I drop the book, it falls down. That has proven to you that gravity exists. But proving a resurrection from the dead is not quite so easy, because dead people do not normally come back to life. Books normally fall when we drop them. Dead people do not normally come back to life. It's called a miracle. And to prove a miracle is difficult. In fact, someone back in the 1700s called David Hume, who was an atheist, wrote a whole book on the subject. And one of the things he said, which I thought was quite wise, was that no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle unless the testimony be of such kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish. In other words, if we want to believe that something happened which seems totally impossible, then the only way we can do that reasonably is to believe that it would be totally impossible for it not to happen. In other words, if we can discount everything else and say that couldn't have happened, then we might believe in a miracle. Otherwise, why would you believe that someone rose from the dead? It doesn't normally happen. It's not a recurring fact. We can't go and make someone else rise from the dead. So if we want to prove that, we need to prove it by showing that nothing else works. And so, tonight, I'm going to make two claims. I'm going to claim, first of all, that it is a reasonable proposition that Jesus Christ was resurrected from the dead, that this is a reasonable explanation of the facts. And secondly, I am going to claim that there is no other reasonable explanation of the facts. You'll notice extensive use of the word reasonable in that. The reason for that is that in a court of law, when we're trying to convict someone in a criminal court, the burden of proof that's laid on the prosecution is that they have to prove he is guilty beyond all reasonable doubt. Obviously, there are some people tonight who are going to be able to doubt me no matter what I say. But I want to be able to prove to you, beyond all reasonable doubt, that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And that's what we're working on tonight. We're not dealing with irreasonable facts. We're dealing with reasonable facts that you should be able to reasonably understand. So, let's start off with some documentary evidence. We read Luke 24 tonight, which is a documentary account that claims that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Here's a few other ones. In fact, in the Bible, we have four different accounts that all claim the same thing, that Jesus Christ was risen from the dead. You see short excerpts from them all up on the slide tonight. I'm not going to go through and read each one, but they all say about the same thing. And I ask you, if you don't believe me, to read it, because they all say about the same thing, that this man rose from the dead. And the interesting thing about this is it's not a single witness. We have four different witnesses. Two of them, Matthew and John, were eyewitnesses of these events. Mark was not an eyewitness. He was writing based on the testimony of another eyewitness, which was Peter. And Luke does not claim to be an eyewitness. His was a compilation. But all of these people were writing at about the same time and all claim that this happened. That should give us an inkling that maybe something happened. It doesn't prove that it did happen, because we're not going to look at these people tonight as inspired by God. That's the position of the Christadelphians. But if their writing is inspired by God, I might as well not be talking tonight anyway, because the case is already proven. If it's inspired, then we believe it and that's it. We're not going to do that tonight. I'm going to assume that these are historical documents, but I'm not going to assume that they're inspired by God. Because if they're inspired by God, we have a circular argument and my case is already over. We're going to assume, though, that they are historical testimony. and we have good reason to assume that. Oh, there's more documentary evidence. We're going to skip that for right now, though. And we're going to look at the veracity of these documents. First of all, when were they written? If Mark had written his gospel 500 years after the events happened, we might have reason to doubt him. But that's not the case. You see up here what I found as the scholarly opinion by those scholars who actually have reason to believe that these authors were not lying. If you believe that the authors were lying, you get a bunch of dates after AD 70. But based on what they actually wrote, the dates are usually in this range, AD 50 to 70, which puts you at most 40 years after the events in K. Question. These were not accounts by people long after the events were passed. These were people who claimed to be eyewitnesses and wrote at a time period where they could be eyewitnesses. Secondly, it's often a question of who actually wrote these gospels. However, based on my research, again, tonight I'm not going to give you a documentary go-over of everything to do with textual analysis of the gospels. What I will say, though, is the authorship was not questioned for any of these for the next 500 years. And so everyone in those time periods, and we have lots of documents, says Mark wrote Mark, Matthew wrote Matthew, John wrote John. And if so, we have good reason to believe that that's the case. These people wrote those books and honestly believed what they wrote. We have these books. That's what they say. And just as a bit of comparison, can we trust that these books, written 2,000 years ago, actually got to us in a reasonable condition? So, up here we have a brief comparison of the textual attestation of the New Testament versus some other contemporary documents. For example, we've got Julius Caesar. You might have heard of him. He was a Roman general who wrote some rather long accounts in Latin about his conquest of the Gaulish nation. And these have been used as basic Latin texts, if you're taking Latin, for a long time. And they're written up in the history books. However, as for manuscripts, we only actually have 10 different manuscripts, ancient manuscripts, not like modern copies, of these events. And the oldest one, as in the closest to when it was written, is 1,000 years afterwards. We're not saying that it was written 1,000 years afterwards. We're saying that it was copied and recopied and recopied, and the newest copy we have is 1,000 years after it was originally written. So there's been lots of time for errors to creep in. And yet we trust that Caesar conquered the Gauls. We have a bunch of other authors here. The last one you'll notice is the New Testament. And the thing is, for the New Testament, it's almost embarrassing just how much evidence we have that the New Testament was written and just how much material we have to go through it and figure out whether or not this is a textually accurate document to what was originally written. You'll notice that the number of manuscripts we have is two orders of magnitude higher than the closest contemporary manuscript, closest contemporary document, which is Homer's The Iliad. You also notice that the time span we have is a lot closer. We have a fragment from the Gospel of John that's identical to what we currently have that was discovered in Egypt that's dated to AD 125, or give or take 1 or 2 years. And that's not much more than 25 years after it was originally written. Now, if you want a complete set, you have to go to about the 3rd century AD. Again, that totally beats Homer's The Iliad in how close we have a copy to when it was originally written. These documents have been well preserved. And there's a quote that I like to read you that was from the conclusion of an article I read on the textual authenticity of the New Testament. And it's like this. Simply put, if we reject the authenticity of the New Testament on textual grounds, we'd have to reject every ancient work of antiquity and declare null and void every piece of historical information from written sources prior to the beginning of the second millennium AD. In other words, if we throw out the New Testament because we can't trust the text, we have to throw out a whole lot of other stuff, because the New Testament is on much better grounds than most of our knowledge of the ancient world. These are not documents that you can discount simply because they're old. Secondly, we have a lot of old documents. We have a lot of new documents that people don't believe because they're not believable. We have fairy tales of, say, Rapunzel. Nobody most scholar that I know of, reputably believes that Rapunzel was an actual person with 8-foot hair that had a prince climb up. There's a question of, are these reliable documents? And for that matter, you have to analyze the document. There have been some excellent books written on this. The one I'd like to point out to you is this one by Frank Morrison called Who Moved the Stone? The introduction of that book is definitely worth reading, because he starts off talking about how he intended to write a book to discover who the real Jesus was after sifting through all the evidence and finding out where was just the made-up stuff and where the real Jesus shone through. And so he was going to read through the book of Mark, look through the last 7 days of Jesus' life, and find out what was true and what wasn't true. And he intended to prove that Jesus did not actually rise from the dead. He ended up becoming a Christian. And his book, Who Moved the Stone, is not a proof that Jesus did not rise from the dead, but a proof that he did rise from the dead. Now, Frank Morrison was a lawyer who did this, and he didn't know about it at the time he was writing Who Moved the Stone. But going through and examining the evidence of each of the different witnesses and cross-examining them and looking at it from a legal perspective was not new. In fact, Simon Greenlee, a professor from a little-known university in the United States called Harvard, had done it a bit earlier back in the 1700s. It's called The Testimony of the Evangelists, and it did the same thing. It went through each of the different Gospels and used the principles of law to go through and figure out, were these testimonies accurate? Did it have a case? Now, I'm not a lawyer yet. So if you want to truly get a legal perspective on these things, you're going to have to read those books. But they're worth looking at, and I found them very convincing. As well, there's a whole lot of things in the record itself that are convincing. I'm only going to pull out some of them because I don't have all night tonight. But this is one that I found particularly interesting. In the Gospel of John, John records, "But when they came to Jesus and found that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. Instead, one of the soldiers pierced Jesus' side with a spear, bringing a sudden flow of blood and water." And why was this recorded? It's recorded because it's weird that if you pierce someone, out comes both blood and water. This is not a normal event. But that's the sort of thing that makes it seem that if it actually truly happened, it would mean that this witness was telling the truth. So, once upon a time, back in about the 1700s again, there was a physiologist at the University of Dublin who decided to run some tests on animals. So, he was also a physiologist, so he'd seen it a lot with humans. So what he did was he pierced lots of left sides with large knives, comparable in size with a Roman spear. And he found that there were 5 distinct cases that could happen. First of all, sometimes he got a flow with nothing, he got nothing at all except some slight trickling of blood. Secondly, sometimes he got a whole lot of blood and then nothing else. Sometimes, though, he got a flow of water and then a few drops of blood. Now, based on these conclusions, he could tell, based on what happened, how the thing died. This is going to use some medical terminology. For example, of these 3 cases, the first is that which usually occurs, as in, on a normal death, you get just a small trickle of blood. The second is found in cases of death by drowning and by strychnia, may be demonstrated by destroying an animal with that poison, and it can be proved to be the natural case of a crucified person. The third is found in cases of death from pleurisy, pericarditis, and rupture of the heart. I'm not a doctor. He's a doctor. You're going to have to depend on him or look up these terms to find out exactly what they mean. His point, though, is that he came up with 2 following cases that aren't normal. These 2 following cases were a copious flow of water succeeded by a copious flow of blood, or a copious flow of blood succeeded by a copious flow of water. And he determined that these would only occur in a crucified person who had previously suffered from pleuritic effusion, or from a crucified person who had died upon the cross from rupture of the heart. In other words, this is a very rare condition that's not going to happen except if you're crucified and your heart bursts. And that's what John saw, which is really interesting. It's a strong case that what he saw was something that actually happened, that this was an eyewitness who saw a very novel circumstance that he wrote down. The next verse is him going, I actually do believe this, and this is what I saw. And he wrote it down, and now we can look at it and go, this is the only case where it would happen. He saw something amazing, and it happened, and we can look at it and say, this is an eyewitness approach. That's cool. It doesn't prove it, but it's a very strong mark of internal consistency, that these are eyewitnesses who are watching what was happening and telling us. There's another very strong point, though, and that is the empty tomb. The quotes up on the screen are kind of long, but they basically explain what the tomb of Jesus was like. It had a large stone in front of it, and it was sealed by the Romans, and it had a guard in front of it. This was all at a time when the body was assumed to be there. But then we read in the record that the body was not found in this tomb. In fact, the body was not found anywhere. This is an amazing thing. Usually bodies don't disappear. In a criminal investigation, in fact, a large portion of time is spent looking for the body, because if you can't find a body, it's hard to establish whether or not the person actually died. And bodies don't usually just disappear. But that seems to have been the case here, because even the very enemies who did not believe that Jesus was resurrected claimed that the body wasn't there. You'll notice in that quote, when the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers, those are the ones who are guarding the tomb, a large sum of money, telling them, you are to say his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. What that means is that the very people who did not believe in the resurrection could not explain where the body had gone. They had to lie and say that the disciples had stolen the body. In other words, there was no body that they could find. That is very strong evidence that Jesus was resurrected from the dead. Because if he was resurrected, then there would be no dead body to find. But if he was not resurrected, then you would expect to find a body somewhere. You would not expect an empty tomb. And you'll notice that throughout the record afterwards, there is no production of the body of Jesus. There was no attempt to say that Jesus actually was dead. When they're persecuting the disciples afterwards, they put them in jail. They get mad at them. But they don't say, here's the body of Jesus. See, he's dead. He's dead. They can't do that because they don't have a body of Jesus to produce. They had to say that the disciples had stolen him because they couldn't find this body. That's powerful. Finally, the reason I'm saying this today is because I am a Christian. I am a Christian in a religion that is based on Jesus Christ. And Christianity is currently a religion of 1.5 to 2.1 billion people nowadays. That means it had to come from somewhere. In fact, it was established as the official religion of the Roman Empire in 380 AD. And it emerged just about the time that Jesus was said to have died and been resurrected. Large religions don't come from nowhere. And that's a large point as well. Any explanation for this death and resurrection of Jesus, any explanation for why we have different witnesses writing around the time period saying that this man was resurrected, has to also be able to explain where Christianity came from. If Jesus was not actually resurrected, how did a religion get started about him? Where did it come from? And another important point. Remember that body? That body that no one could find? Christians are not lacking in veneration of holy artifacts. If you go throughout Europe, you will find lots of pieces of the true cross, or pieces of nails from the cross, or worship of statues. If you go to the Holy Land, you'll find out that this is where Jesus walked, and this is where his tomb was, etc. But there is nowhere where it's, this was where Jesus is buried. There is no, this is where his body was. There's a tomb that they'll say this is where he was buried, but it's an empty tomb in Jerusalem. If Jesus actually died and left a body, you'd expect for all this big religion based around him to venerate it. And it's not there. There's no body of Jesus that's venerated by Christians. It's unanimously taught that he rose from the dead, and there is no body. That's strong. That means that we have this large religion here that believes that someone rose from the dead and has no evidence against it themselves. Okay, that's not so strange. But we have to explain where Christianity came from. So as a general conclusion to the first part of my lecture tonight, Christianity definitely exists nowadays. Documents from the time period when it was formed say that it started with the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Christianity cannot exist without the resurrection of Jesus Christ, in that Christianity as a religion is useless without it. The documents we have are original and internally consistent. And for all these things, I say that it is reasonable to assume that if a man actually was resurrected, it is reasonable to assume that documents of the time period would say he was resurrected. It is reasonable to assume that those people who were affected by a miracle like that would go around and preach it. It is reasonable to assume that a man who claimed something as miraculous as his own death and resurrection could convince people to go and spread a religion in his name. That seems reasonable to assume if he actually was resurrected. But that doesn't mean other people haven't come up with ideas about how this could have worked. We're going to cover four of them tonight. They're called the swoon theory, the conspiracy theory, the hallucination theory, and the myth theory. These basically run from least plausible to most plausible. So let's start off with the swoon theory. The basic idea of the swoon theory is that Jesus didn't really die on the cross. He was knocked unconscious by, in some way, came back to a state of consciousness inside the tomb, and that's why everyone thought he was resurrected. He didn't actually die in the first place. There's a lot of problems with this theory. The first one is that Jesus was crucified. Crucifixion was designed to kill people. Our documents from the time period say he was verified to be dead. Romans usually knew what they were doing when they were executing people. So it doesn't seem likely that they would have made a mistake in this circumstance. But say they did. We also happen to know that this tomb that Jesus was in was guarded and sealed and had a big stone in front of it. So this man who has been beaten and crucified somehow survived that, comes to unconsciousness in a tomb with a large stone in front of it, surrounded by soldiers. This is a problem as well. But say, for instance, he manages, in his weakened state, to roll the stone out of the way, break through the soldiers who are around, and make it to his disciples. We then have the problem that if Jesus actually didn't die, his disciples are liars. And in that case, he's a liar as well. And we're not dealing with the swoon theory at all. What we're dealing with is a conspiracy, where his disciples made up the fact that he was resurrected for their own benefits. Because if Jesus wasn't actually resurrected and managed to survive this thing and came to them bloody and beaten, bruised and dehydrated and half dead, they wouldn't believe he was resurrected. So we're dealing with the wrong theory here anyway. It's not the swoon theory. And you still have to deal with the fact that if he didn't actually get resurrected, he must have died at some point, and where is that body? But we have the next theory, which is the conspiracy theory, that the disciples made it all up. There was some sort of Passover plot where they decided to trick everyone and say that Jesus actually was resurrected when he'd honestly died. Maybe they stole the body, we don't know, but it was all a plot by the disciples. This one has some problems as well, though. First of all, why? What is the motive of these disciples to trick everyone with their Passover plot? If Jesus actually was a liar and hadn't risen from the dead, why would they still believe in him? What is there to be gained from helping a dead man, for glorifying the name of someone who is dead and has proved to everyone that he can't save because he couldn't save himself? We have the problem of motivation. They, what did they have to gain from supporting someone they knew was a dead horse? Also, we have the problem that we have documents written by these disciples. And in these documents, they say they didn't believe. They didn't believe that he was going to rise from the dead. They thought that he was dead as normal, as you would expect. If they'd come up with this conspiracy to say that he wasn't dead when he was dead, why wouldn't they have made themselves look a little bit better, rather than looking like faithless idiots who didn't believe their own master? If this is a conspiracy, they could have done a lot to making themselves look better as part of this conspiracy. Thirdly, usually plots like this come out. Over time, when they were persecuted, when they were going throughout the Roman Empire trying to make these converts, why didn't anyone defect? Why didn't anyone get out there and reveal the plot? And finally, when you have authorities who are trying their very best to defeat this movement, why didn't they manage to figure this out, find out where the disciples had hidden the body and uncover it? This is not easy to understand. The conspiracy theory, in my opinion, requires more faith than to believe that he was resurrected from the dead, because it requires men to do things that give them no benefit, pull it off absolutely perfectly, and prevent authorities from finding it out as well. You need perfect actions by people for no reason. That seems unlikely. The next theory we have is the hallucination theory. Not that these disciples deliberately tricked everyone, but let's avoid the whole motive problem and say they were tricked themselves. They believed Jesus was resurrected from the dead, and they did all these actions because they thought he was resurrected, and they just seen a bunch of hallucinations. It's been known to happen when people go through emotional trying circumstances dealing with death. But this, again, has some problems. First of all, that body. Where is the body? If Jesus was not actually resurrected, we still have the problem of where did the body go? And if the disciples were deceived, they couldn't have stolen the body. So where is the body? Why do we have this empty tomb? It doesn't answer that question. Secondly, the idea that it could have been a hallucination is not new. We read in Luke 24 that they thought it was a hallucination. By their own testimony, when Jesus appeared to them, they thought they were hallucinating, and he had to prove to them that he wasn't a hallucination. So if it was a hallucination, this was a mighty good hallucination, because it managed to prove to people who were convinced it was a hallucination that it wasn't. And the way they say he proved it to them was by eating to the, in front of them, talking to them, and by touching his wounds. We have a mighty fine hallucination if people are able to hallucinate all of that. As well, we've got a hallucination that not only manages to prove itself not to be hallucination, but also manages to hang around for exactly 40 days, so a repeated hallucination, and then stop appearing after those 40 days, after they had this magnificent hallucination of it going up into heaven. As far as the hallucination theory goes, we require miraculous hallucination for this to happen. And our burden of proof already was that we want something that seems less miraculous, not more miraculous. To believe in the hallucination theory, you need to believe in a greater miracle than Jesus rising from the dead. Now, the final theory we're going to look at is the myth theory. The myth theory is the one you'll find most often in scholarly works. The idea that these documents were written as a myth, and we can compare them with other myths, such as myths about Osiris or about certain Roman Catholic saints, and say, those are obviously lousy tales invented by people to pump up someone they thought was important. And the Gospels, the whole New Testament, in fact, is just the same way. It's a myth that people came up with that was produced over time, and it didn't really happen. The problem with that is, as far as myths go, the New Testament is a pretty lousy myth. First of all, it was written within 40 years of the events happening. It's hard to create myths quite that fast. The reason for that is, let's take an example of someone who just recently died. Say, Ronald Reagan. There are people still alive who knew Ronald Reagan. If I wrote a biography of Ronald Reagan, in which I said that every morning he would strap wings on his back and fly up in the sky in the area and then come back down, I might sell a few copies of my biography. But anyone who knew Ronald Reagan would know that he didn't actually do that. And they would say that my biography was a pack of lies. It probably wouldn't get preserved because people would consider it a pack of lies, and we wouldn't have 24,000 manuscripts of it to look at. That's the problem we have with considering it a myth. It's too soon. Myths develop over time, after people can't really say whether something was true or not, not during the time when we still have eyewitnesses. As well, you have the problem of myths don't develop out of nothing. You need to have some solid fact. And who was this real non-mythical Jesus, then, who the myth was based around? Because the Jesus we have claimed that he was risen from the dead. And the disciples we have writing afterwards say that he rose from the dead. And if there was actually a real Jesus who didn't really rise from the dead and got made up afterwards, we have to figure out who he actually was. And so far, he seems like a liar and a cheat. Because he said things that didn't actually happen. Also, the same argument can be applied to the New Testament as a whole. In 2 Peter 1 and 16, it's claimed, I'll read that for you. We did not follow cleverly invented stories when we told you about the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. Obviously, people at the time had come up with these same theories and were throwing them at them. And in the New Testament, we find defenses that these were not cleverly invented stories. Sounds a lot like a myth to me. That they'd come up with to try and make up this wonderful savior. If they say something like that, it leaves two conclusions. Either they're telling the truth, or they're lying. If they're lying, we're back to the conspiracy theory. And if they're telling the truth, then Jesus was resurrected. So, now that we've gone through... And here's something else that's interesting. The Gospels don't read like myths. They read like eyewitness accounts. We have up there a comparison for you between the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of John. The Gospel of Peter is largely viewed to be a myth. We don't have many manuscripts of that because it was widely reputed in its own time to be a forgery. But read it. It's kind of interesting. So let's see what it says. It says that, okay, this is talking about when Jesus was resurrected. Again, they see three men come forth from the tomb, and two of them supporting one, and a cross following them. And of the two, the head reached unto the heaven, but the head of him who was led by them overpassed the heavens. And they heard a voice from the heavens saying, "Thou hast preached to them that sleep," and a response was heard from the cross. Yea. So, in this myth, we have people with hugely over-exaggerated dimensions, since their heads are way up there, and we have this gigantic talking cross. In the Gospel of John, we have, this is the same passage you saw earlier with another verse attached, we have a description of something he clearly considers miraculous, and but which we can find out not to be miraculous, instead a description of a very specific event. And we have someone going, claiming eyewitness testimony. The man who saw it has given testimony, and his testimony is true. He knows that he tells the truth, and he testifies so that you may also believe. The Gospels don't read like myths, and I invite you to read some myths and compare the Gospels to them and see if they're the same sort of thing. Because they aren't. Verify me on it if you want. They don't read like myths. They are written like eyewitness accounts. So let's take a look at what conclusions we can make from this. I believe I have demonstrated that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is a reasonable explanation of the facts. If a man honestly was resurrected from the dead, we have a good explanation for why we have the existence of Christianity as a religion. We have a good explanation for why we have all these accounts, all these documents claiming that he rose from the dead. It makes sense if a man actually did get resurrected from the dead. I also claim that these other explanations that we've looked at at are not reasonable explanations, that they require you to believe in a greater miracle than that Jesus actually was resurrected from the dead. And so, based on these two conclusions, I derive a third conclusion. And that conclusion is that if Jesus did rise from the dead, then we have to believe what else he said. And the other thing that he said is that he's going to come back. And when he comes back, we need to be ready for it. In Acts 17, verse 31, it says, "For God has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead." It's not my subject tonight. But if Jesus was resurrected from the dead, it doesn't just mean that a man was resurrected from the dead and that's amazing. It means that the other things he said were true as well, because him being resurrected from the dead was the proof that was given for him for the other things that he said. And he said that he is going to come back and judge the world, and we need to be ready for that. And so tonight, I hope I've demonstrated to you that we can believe beyond all reasonable doubt that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And I hope I've also demonstrated to you that this is not just head knowledge, but that it's vitally important, because if Jesus Christ did rise from the dead, then it requires action on our part, because we need to be ready when the next thing happens that he miraculously prophesied.
Thank you for listening to the Good Christadelphian Talks podcast. We hope this talk helped you in your walk. If you would like to hear more, please subscribe for new episodes and leave a review in Apple Podcast or whichever service you are using to help more people find the show when they search for it. If you enjoyed this particular talk, please share it with someone who you think might enjoy it as well. For show notes on the talk you just listened to, visit our show page at anchor.fm/GCT or check the show notes section of your podcast player. Please share your thoughts on the talk from this week on our Facebook or Instagram pages, where we are at Good Christadelphian Talks, on Twitter, where we are at GCT_podcast, or leave a comment on our YouTube channel, where these talks are posted as well. If you know of a great talk, we want to know about it too. Send a suggestion to our email at goodchristadelphiantalks@gmail.com or message us on any of our social media accounts. Thank you for listening. God bless, and talk to you next week.